Well, everyone, I'm so excited to kick off this Easter Sunday, to kick off a brand new sermon series that we are doing called Christianity for People Who Aren't Christians. The title and much of the content from this series comes from a book of the same name by author James Emery White. I just want to make sure I'm giving credit where credit is due. It's an excellent, excellent book, and if you're someone who is curious about the Christian faith, I would highly recommend this. In fact, what our church would love to do for you is, if this is your first time joining us, if you're a guest, if you're someone who would say maybe you're skeptical or curious about the Christian faith, we're actually going to post a link in the comments section, that'll take you to a form, and if you fill that out and put your address in, we will mail you a copy of this book for free. We'd love just a way for us to say thank you so much for joining us this morning. So, welcome. So, in this sermon series, I'm going to try to accomplish a few things. There's three key things that I want to accomplish. The first thing is I'm going to do my best to explain Christianity and the Christian faith in a way that doesn't assume that you already have a foundational knowledge or understanding of it. And I don't mean this in a condescending way at all. In fact, I mean that in the best way imaginable, and that is that you're simply a normal person. I'm going to assume that you, like most people today, don't have a foundational knowledge or understanding of the Christian faith. Simply put, I'm not going to assume that you have an undergraduate degree in biblical studies. Secondly, I'd like to answer some of the more common questions that people standing outside of the Christian faith are asking about. And to be honest with you, these are good questions. These are fair questions. These are questions that should be asked for those who are curious about Christianity. And finally, if you already consider yourself a Christian, if you're here with us this morning and you're like, you know what, Joe, I sang that song, I Believe, and man, do I ever believe. My hope is that you would really benefit from eavesdropping in on this conversation over the next few weeks. Because chances are, if you're a person of faith, you know that you don't have all the answers. And more than that, if you're really honest with yourself, you would know that maybe there are things about Christianity you don't fully understand, or there's teachings in Christianity that you struggle with. And if you're really honest, you'll admit that sometimes you might have some doubts. Because believing doesn't mean that you don't have questions, and believing doesn't mean that you don't have doubts. So my hope is that we can all grow a little deeper in our relationship with Jesus throughout this series. There was an article on Forbes on their website titled "The Top Earnings of Dead Celebrities in 2019. I mean, talk about clickbait, right? How can you not click on something like that? And there was a whole list of celebrities who were earning money after their death just through different royalties and business deals and stuff that they have made. So I'm just going to give you the top five, okay? So number five, we've got Bob Marley, the king of reggae from Jamaica. Last year, 2019, he raked in $20 million. Number four on the list is Arnold Palmer. You may know him as a famous golfer, and also, you know, he has the rights to the drink, the Arnold Palmer. So he raked in $30 million last year. Number three is Charles Schulz at $38 million. This is, of course, the beloved creator of Peanuts comics, Charlie Brown and Snoopy. Number two, the king himself, Elvis. Elvis Presley raked in $39 million in 2019. And top one, almost doubling that, with $60 million, is Michael Jackson. You know, it's absolutely amazing how people who are long gone can continue to have influence, be relevant, and be engaging to future generations. But those names are nothing compared to the most influential person who has ever lived, Jesus Christ. But you would have never seen his influence coming. In his book, James Emery White writes this. He said he was born in a small, obscure village of somewhat questionable repute. The child of a peasant woman, He didn't go to high school or college. In fact, he never traveled more than 200 miles from the place where he was born. He never wrote a book. He never held public office. And he was only 33 years old when the tide of public opinion turned against him, prompting even his closest friends to abandon him. He was then turned over to his enemies and was nailed to a wooden cross between two criminals. While he was dying, his executioners gambled for his clothing, the only property he had on earth. After he died, he was laid in a borrowed grave through the pity of an acquaintance. Yet today, he is arguably the central figure of the entire human race. You see, regardless of what you believe about Jesus, his life has left an incredible impact on history. Believers and skeptics alike are perplexed in the wake of his life. And so this morning I want to answer the question, so who was Jesus? So who was Jesus really, this famous person that we've all heard about, but maybe don't know very much about? One very common belief about Jesus' life was that he never existed, that he is simply a myth. And for as common as this viewpoint is, it may surprise you to know that there isn't a scholar alive today who actually believes it. There isn't a reputable scholar out there who denies that Jesus is a historical person who walked this earth. Now, what they believe about Jesus might be completely different. There may be lots of different views about who he was, but no historical scholar takes this idea of Jesus being a myth seriously at all. So Jesus was a real person. And so if he was a real person, you might be wondering, you know, what does Jesus look like? You may have seen lots of different depictions of Jesus, and they all look a little bit different. And to be honest with you, no one really knows for certain what Jesus looked like. What is clear, though, is what he did not look like. Jesus did not have blue eyes, long flowing blonde hair, and chiseled good looks. I'm sorry to be the one to break it to you. In fact, the Bible actually tells us that there was nothing about Jesus' physical appearance that would attract us or draw us to him. And so I also hate to be the one to break this to you, but Jesus was not white. Jesus was a Hebrew, and so he was born in the Middle East, and he would have looked like a Middle Eastern male. He did not speak in King James English. He didn't say thee or thou, and so if you use those words, it doesn't make you more spiritual. Jesus spoke in the word Aramaic. Sorry, in the language of Aramaic was his native tongue, but as a boy, he would have also been taught Hebrew and Greek. The earliest portrait of Jesus in existence dates back to the 5th century. It's the painting of Christ Pantocrator. So, and it's right here. And so the question is this what Jesus looked like? Potentially, but we don't really know. And that's kind of the point, is it really wasn't what Jesus looked like that made all the fuss. What really got things going was what Jesus said and what he did. And so let's take a look at who Jesus said that he was. You know, well, there's lots of different opinions about who Jesus was, but let's take a look at how he self-identified, who he said that he was. On one occasion, Jesus made this very bold claim. He said this, he says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced as he looked forward to my coming. He saw it and was glad. The people said, 'You aren't even 50 years old. How can you say you have seen Abraham?' Jesus answered, 'I tell you the truth, before Abraham was even born, I am.' At that point, they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus was hidden from them and left the temple." See, when Jesus said, "I am," people immediately wanted to kill him. And it wasn't because he was bad at grammar. They wanted to kill Jesus because he said something extremely significant. And the significance of "I am" goes all the way back to one of the very famous stories in the Bible, the story of Moses at the burning bush. Moses, an early leader in Israel's history, God revealed himself to him through a burning bush. And God gave him his name. He said, "I am who I am." And this name was considered sacred. This name couldn't even be uttered. It was the Hebrew word Yahweh. And you couldn't even speak this name out of reverence for that name. And so when Jesus said that before Abraham, that was the father of Israel, before even Moses was around, before Abraham, I am, he was taking the very name of God for himself. He claimed to be God. And this was blasphemy. And so immediately the crowd got angry and they picked up stones and they wanted to throw them at Jesus and kill him. On other occasions, Jesus called himself the Son of God, which is the same as making himself equal with God. Or he would say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And so what do you do with that? People at Jesus' day were confused about what to make of him, and maybe you're confused this morning about what to make of him. What do you do with someone who goes around claiming to be God? What do you do with someone who goes and does and says the things that Jesus did? Well, believe it or not, there are really only four options. There's really only four options about where Jesus, how you can view Jesus. And you'll probably find that you fit into one of these four categories. The first, and I'll say very popular opinion, is simply that Jesus was a great moral teacher. That yes, he was a historical figure. Yes, he lived and died, but he was just really a good guy. Maybe if you're generous, he was like a prophet even. He just taught a lot of good things. Here's where this gets a little bit tricky. No great religious or moral teacher ever claimed to be God, except for Jesus. Not Buddha, not Mohammed, not Confucius. Only Jesus made such an audacious claim. No religious leader would dare to say the things that Jesus said. And besides that, if Jesus claimed to be God, and he wasn't, it would either mean that he was mentally ill, or that he was an evil cult leader, knowingly leading people astray. So let's look at this option about Jesus being mentally ill. When you read the teachings of Jesus, if you actually take the time to study for yourself and to look into the eyewitness accounts of the teachings of Jesus, it becomes very hard to believe that Jesus was mentally ill. When you read the things that he said, they're so profound and so deep, it's hard to believe that he would be institutionalized today. Psychiatrist J.T. Fisher actually called Jesus' great sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, the perfect example of mental health. Okay, so what about Jesus being evil? What about him being a demon? You know, many people in Jesus' day thought that he was just that, an evil person willfully deceiving the masses. But like believing that Jesus was mentally ill, just a quick reading of the eyewitness accounts of Jesus and the things that he said and the things that he did and the love that he showed to the unlovable and those on the fringes of society, his care for people who didn't even have common dignity, when you look at the love and the life of Jesus, it's really hard. It's really hard to stomach a view that Jesus was evil. And so that really leaves us with only a fourth option. And that's that you can believe that Jesus is precisely who he said he was. That he's none other than the Son of God. C.S. Lewis, an Oxford scholar who actually became a Christian on a road to disproving Christianity, put it this way. He said, I'm trying to prevent anyone from saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, on the level with a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit on him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any of this patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. So the four options of how we can view Jesus really are only three. Call him a liar, a lunatic, or Lord. And so let's just say that Jesus really was who he said he was. Why did he come? If Jesus was really God, why leave his throne in heaven? Why leave eternity and come into to time and space and become a man? Why go to all of that extreme? See, the Christian faith holds that we were created to be in a perfect relationship with God. That in many ways he was our first love, but that something went terribly, horribly wrong. And that catastrophe is what theologians call the fall. Humanity chose to be their own gods. They chose to reject and to push aside the plan that God had for us and instead go and do things their own way. And it only takes a simple glance at history to know that things haven't gone great. That to put it mildly, we haven't done a very good job. And so sin entered the world, and it corrupts everything and everyone that it touches. So sin fractured not only our relationship with God, but also our relationship with each other. Greed, pride, lying, hate, and murder all destroy relationships. And we know this. This is why we rage at greedy people right now who are making a profit off of this pandemic. This is why we throw up our hands in exasperation about political leaders who are more concerned about themselves than others. And why we get so frustrated when everyone hogs all of the toilet paper, right? Because we weren't created just to think about ourselves, to be prideful and to be inward focused. And more than that, in each and every one of us, there's this longing for spirituality. There's this longing for something more, but it seems disjointed and distant and out of place, and something isn't quite right. But Jesus came to fix all of that, to completely eradicate evil, not only from this world, but from the most corrupt place of all, the human heart. See, Jesus came to restore us back into a relationship with himself, to pay for what you and what I have done, and to bring us back into a perfect relationship, not only with himself, not only with God, but with all of those around us. You see, God is love, and he would rather give us the choice to love him and literally have all hell break loose than to make us love him. Now that sounds like a pretty bold statement, but I want you to think about that for a second. See, it's easy to say that God could have just waved a magic wand and the world would be made right and everyone would love each other and they'd love him and things would just be the way they're supposed to be. There'd be no more suffering or death or pain. We could have just avoided all of that. But by its very nature, love cannot be commanded. Love must be freely given. James Emery White writes this. He says, God could have made us love him, but if he had, his relationship with us and ours with him would have been meaningless. Meaningless. And so instead, Jesus humbled himself. He came down to our level and ultimately died on the cross on Good Friday, so that we could have a relationship with him. See, he has already chosen to love us, to love you. He came to win our love. And the question that each and every one of us has to ask ourselves is, how will we respond to such a love? How will we respond? Now, this all sounds really nice if it's true, doesn't it? Right? Only God can forgive sins. Only God can do what Jesus claimed to have done. And so how do we know? How do we know that Jesus is actually who he said he was? How do we know that Jesus was actually God with skin on? How can we be certain of this? See, if I came to you and I told you that I was God and I came to bring everyone into relationship with myself and make everything great again and whole again, you would have every right to say, okay, prove it. Joe, you know, you show me. How are you going to do this? You show me that you are who you say you are. And people certainly demanded proof from Jesus. And he definitely did his fair share of miracles. Rumor has it he did everything from turning water into wine to even raising the dead. But there was an ultimate, indisputable proof that Jesus had planned: dying and coming back to life. One day, Jesus was talking to a group of skeptics, and they were demanding that Jesus prove it. They were demanding that Jesus proved that he was who he said he was. And Jesus responds this way. One day, some teachers of the religious law and the Pharisees came to Jesus and said, "Teacher, we want you to show us a miraculous sign to prove your authority." But Jesus replied, "Oh, only an evil, adulterous generation would demand a miraculous sign. But the only sign I will give them is the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was in the belly of the great fish for 3 days and three nights, so will the Son of Man be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights." Even more plainly, in a conversation with his disciples leading up to his death and resurrection, Jesus predicted those events. Taking the 12 disciples aside, Jesus said, "Listen, we're going up to Jerusalem, where all the predictions of the prophets concerning the Son of Man will come true. He will be handed over to the Romans, and he will be mocked, treated shamefully, and spit upon. They will flog him with a whip and kill him. But on the third day, he will rise again." See, Jesus was about to do something that no one in history of the world has ever done, and no one has ever done since. He was going to die and raise himself from the dead. And this Easter Sunday, we celebrate that he did just that. That Jesus really did rise from the dead. That he really is who he said he is. Now, you might be thinking, hang on a second. You're saying that he actually rose from the dead. You're saying that Jesus actually physically rose from the dead. I don't care what you say. Dead people don't rise. It just doesn't happen. And you're absolutely right. It doesn't. And that is the whole point. That is why, if Jesus rose from the dead, it changes everything. No one but God himself could have done such a thing. In the words of Ann Lee Stanley, Christianity rises and falls on the resurrection. If the resurrection is true, we are the most blessed people in the entire universe. And if it's false, we are the most to be pitied in the entire world. But Christianity is not a blind faith. It is a faith that is built on evidence. So let's take a look at the evidence. Did Jesus really rise from the dead? We're talking a physical resurrection here, not some kind of philosophical symbolism. We're talking a dead person coming to life. There are four main objections to the resurrection. And I want to kind of give you a synopsis of all of them. Now, to understand, there are so many eyewitness accounts of the resurrection that the best way to handle this is to take those accounts seriously and to say, okay, was this some kind of conspiracy or was this actually true? So there are basically four main conspiracy theories behind the resurrection of Jesus. The first is that the disciples stole the body. This view holds that the disciples, in desperation to keep hope alive, stole Jesus' body and just lied about the resurrection. The problem with this theory is that it would have been impossible for a group of 12 ragtag disciples to steal the body of Jesus. This was precisely the sort of thing that the Romans and the Jewish religious leaders absolutely wanted to prevent. And so they dispatched a group of Roman legionaries to guard the tomb. And we're not talking like one or two. Like we're talking like 10 or 15 like trained Roman soldiers here. And more than that, Roman soldiers were famous for their ability to keep night watch. In fact, the penalty for falling asleep if you were on night watch was death. And so they took it very seriously not to fall asleep. But even if all of the Roman soldiers fell asleep, rolling away the 2-ton stone that covered the tomb, like that makes a lot of noise. You think they probably would have woken up. But even if, okay, even if the disciples pulled this off, they really messed up big time when they fabricated the eyewitness accounts. The first witnesses, the first eyewitnesses to the resurrection were women. Now, before you hate me, let me explain. In that time, in Jewish culture, the testimony of a woman was not credible. If a woman saw a crime committed and they went to court, her testimony would be completely discounted. And so the question is, if you were trying to pull off the greatest hoax that the world has ever seen, you think that you would find a better alibi. You think that you would find a better, more reliable witness. But they didn't, because they were simply recording the facts of what happened. And finally, of the disciples who allegedly stole the body, even if all of that was a hoax and they managed to pull it all off, of the disciples who allegedly stole the body, all but one, John, who was later exiled to the island of Patmos, were killed for their faith. Every single one of them was martyred. And that's something we have to take very seriously, because someone might die for something that they think is true. But no one dies for something that they know is a lie. And so we have to ask ourselves, why would the disciples be willing to die for the resurrection? The second conspiracy theory is that the Jewish or Roman authorities stole the body. And the answer to this is in the first answer. The very last thing that the authorities wanted, the very last thing that they wanted was for Jesus to be resurrected. Or thought to be resurrected. In fact, if you look at history, they spent years following the resurrection, trying to stamp out Christianity, persecuting Christians, feeding them to the lions. They did not want Jesus to rise from the dead. They did not want it to look like Jesus rose from the dead. They simply did not have the motive. Why would they fuel the fire that they tried so hard to stamp out? The third is that the disciples simply went to the wrong tomb, that they were mistaken. They took a left turn somewhere, and they found the wrong tomb. But again, with this one, if the Romans and the Jewish religious leaders were so excited to stamp out Christianity, and the disciples went around saying, hey, Jesus rose from the dead, don't you think they would roll away the stone, grab Jesus' corpse, and parade it around saying, look, he's dead. These are false claims. The fourth conspiracy is that Jesus didn't really die. He simply passed out from exhaustion and pain. In order to understand this view, you need to understand what was involved in the death of Jesus. In the eyewitness accounts of Jesus' crucifixion, he was first given 39 lashes with a cat o' nine tails. And basically, this was a whip that the Romans would use, and it had shards of bone and metal on the end. It was weighted. And when they would whip someone, they would drive into the flesh on their back, and they would pull, and it would rip the flesh that it was attached to out. And it was very common for bone to be exposed in the back of their victims. 40 lashes was considered the death penalty. Jesus received 39. They then dug a crown of thorns into his head. And we're not talking thistle bushes or rose bushes here. We're talking like 2-3-inch like thorns. And to put that on his head, to drive that into his skull, the pain and the loss of blood alone would have been enough to kill him. And then he was forced to carry his cross to the hill where he was going to be crucified. And understandably, he collapsed from exhaustion and pain and was not able to carry the cross up the hill. And so they had a bystander carry the cross to the hill for Jesus. When he got up there, they nailed into his wrists and into his feet into a cross. And the cross was a death by asphyxiation is basically what it was. It was death by suffocation. And you would hang there. And in order to breathe properly, you'd have to push yourself up with your feet. And the pain would be so excruciating that you would have to time your breaths very carefully, and eventually you would be so exhausted and it would hurt so much that you just would suffocate. You couldn't push yourself up any longer. But after Jesus died, or where this view would say, after he passed out, the Romans wanted to make sure that he was dead. Not like Miracle Max would say in The Princess Bride, mostly dead, but dead. And so they came up to him with a spear, and they shoved it into his side, and the records say that blood and water came out. Now, they probably didn't know what this meant at the time that was written. But medically now, we know that what that means is that the spear punctured the pericardium that protects the heart. Meaning that absolutely, medically speaking, without a shadow of a doubt, Jesus was dead. He was then covered in pounds and pounds of heavy burial clothes and laid in a tomb for 3 days. There is no coming back from that unless you are the Son of God. So right now you're probably thinking, like, hang on, Joe, just stop here. Hold the phone for a second. You are not going to convince me through some kind of hypothetical scenario that Jesus rose from the dead. I don't care what the evidence says, dead people don't rise. That is precisely the point. This isn't an intellectual game. If Jesus actually rose from the dead, he's who he said he was. Everything that he said and did was true. And more than that, if he rose from the dead, that means that we can as well. And ask Alexis to come on up. See, Jesus himself said that he has come to give us life, and life in all its fullness. That we can experience true life, not just when we die, but life starting today. That he can not only resurrect our physical bodies, but our spiritual bodies as well. That he can truly take the spiritually dead and bring them alive and awake within them love and hope and peace and faith and life. In fact, this transformation is so complete that the Bible actually says that you become a new person. And so how can we experience this new life? How can we experience this relationship with God that Jesus came to bring us into and this relationship with others? How can we receive that? By simply believing in Jesus. See, to be a Christian is to simply believe that Jesus is precisely who he said he was. A New Testament scholar, N.T. Wright, in his book, Simply Christian, defines what it means to be Christian this way. He says, to follow Jesus Christ into the new world, God's world, which he has thrown open before us. Now, obviously, you have the choice to do with this information what you want. It's completely up to you. You can deny him, you can call him crazy, but the one thing that you cannot do is be indifferent towards Jesus. You can't just shrug Jesus off as a great moral teacher and go about your day. He has not left that option open to us. Each and every one of us must answer the question that Jesus asked his disciples, so long ago, when Jesus laid some hard truth down and tons of people left him and they deserted him, Jesus looked at Peter, one of his disciples, and he said, "Who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? I don't care about what anyone else says. You. Who do you believe that Jesus is?" And that is the moment, that the question that every single person needs to answer. And I want to challenge you to answer that question, to do, I don't know where you're at, do the research if you need to. But answer the question, who do you say that Jesus is? And if you want, if you are ready, right now I'm going to invite you to take your first steps into this new world. If you want to put faith in Jesus, if you want to experience the hope and the life and the joy of the resurrection, if you want Jesus to be your Lord and Savior, I want you to pray the simple prayer with me right now. Dear Heavenly Father, I know that I've messed up, that I'm a sinner. I believe in Jesus. And I ask that you would make me completely new. Lead me into your new world. I believe. Amen. If you prayed that prayer in your heart or with your mouth, you are a new person. You have been resurrected. And one day you too will be resurrected with Jesus. I would love to hear from you. There's going to be another link in the comments for you to get in touch with me. And I'd love to have a conversation with you over FaceTime or Skype or whatever we can do. I would just love to meet you. Thank you all so much for joining us this Easter Sunday. Let us sing that song again, My Testimony. Our story of those who have their hope and their faith solidly in Jesus.